thanks for doing your part to financially support your public radio station. Today on Travel with Rick Steves, we're feasting with all of our senses. And for a visual treat, it's hard to do better than an English country garden. In fact, my three English guests, Gillian Chadwick, Tom Hooper, and Roy Nichols, were so inspired by the topic, they burst into song.
La 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 in an English country garden.
So Roy Nichols, Gillian Chadwick, Tom Hooper, all musical guides.
Absolutely.
I've never heard you guys sing.
So you can tell.
Musical gardens.
You know, I am not into gardens. If I don't know what the opposite color of a green is, but that's the color
black.
Of my thumb. Black. I've got
black
a
thumb.
Black thumb. But when I'm in Britain, I gotta say I'm really blown away by the gardens. I enjoy them. Hidcote Manor, Bodnant Gardens. Beautiful gardens. What is it that distinguishes an English garden?
I think it's because so many of the continental gardens are so manicured and so organized.
Yeah.
And at the heart of a true English cottage garden is a certain amount of disorganization.
You mean weeds?
Not weeds. Anyway, weed is just a flower in the wrong place.
Yes.
I think it's that not over-organized, a certain amount of disorganization, a riot of color, not worrying too much about matching colors and everything else like this, throwing all sorts of plants together that normally you wouldn't associate with each other. And it gives that very sort of almost wildness about it. And I think that's at the heart
of
it.
So there's an intentional roughness.
Yes,
definitely.
Yes. So it's not over-manicured, over-organized. Yes.
Because when I'm at Beatrix Potter's cottage, it's just a beautiful sort of festival of color, but it doesn't seem very well organized.
That would be very typical of a house garden.
And that's quite deliberate.
Maybe it goes back to the Romantic era when people,
I think it has a much longer history than that. Mm-hmm. One thinks about the 18th and 19th centuries, the Romantic movement and the picturesque movement. But that beginnings of English country gardening go back to medieval times.
Where might we see something like that in our travels?
There's a wonderful, there's the Physic Garden in Chelsea, which is a good example of one of those early herb gardens. There's the Wealden Downland Museum in Sussex, not far outside of Chichester. This is a recreation of or rebuilding of medieval buildings on a particular site. And they have some wonderful recreations of medieval gardens.
It is quite interesting how when centuries roll by, different influences come into the way you design your garden. So the medieval gardens give way to Tudor gardens. And then when you get to the 18th century, there is this idea, we must control nature. So you have great landscape gardeners like Capability Brown, who at places like Blenheim Palace.
Capability Brown, this is the guy's name. Yeah. He's a great landscape architect.
He wasn't christened that.
No.
Sir Lancelot. And he'd arrive and say, I have the capability.
Oh, that was his nickname.
Yes. Yes.
So he was a very proud man, proud gardener.
I have the capability to turn your estate into the best view in England.
So they called him Capability Brown.
Yes.
What are the top two or three names to remember among landscape architects in Britain? Le Notre, that would be a Frenchman.
Yes. Yeah.
Did he have an impact in England?
He came over to landscape Greenwich.
Because you find his work in the Loire Valley and the chateaus there. Capability Brown.
Gertrude Jekyll. Sissinghurst, Virginia Woolf.
Vita
Sackville West.
But I think the important thing is it tends to be the polite buildings, the large estates, the large country houses that tend to adopt the continental fashions in gardening, whether it's Italian or French. But it's the English country gardens that remain constant and that sort of naturalness.
English country gardens. What's a good example of that?
Places Sissinghurst in Kent.
Hidcote has it as well.
What about just at Kew Gardens? That's probably the most famous opportunity.
How could we forget?
Roy, what's Kew Gardens?
It's the main sort of headquarters and gardens of the Royal Horticultural Society.
Botanical
Society.
Uh-huh. And it's got this industrial age iron and glass structure, which is quite striking on
those
its own.
Those great greenhouses of the 19th century, which could be really large and elaborate, it's the ultimate one in Kew.
Oh, and it's like going to the jungle in London.
It is.
But all country houses would have had them on a large or small scale, growing exotic things like oranges and pineapples
and that must
for the
have
country
been a big
house.
Deal in the 19th century to grow this sort of thing.
And pineapples are so expensive, you could rent them for the evening and return them the next day.
Rent? Only in Britain can you rent a pineapple. That's pretty good. Now, is it my imagination or does Anne Hathaway's cottage up in Shakespeare's House?
Yes.
It's a gorgeous...
Yes.
That really, I just thought it was like an explosion of color.
Yeah. Mm.
And also a classic English garden because it seemed intentionally messy.
And set against the beautiful outside of the
with the
cottage,
thatches coming thatch, down. It's like the thatches are like bangs on a hairdryer.
And I think that is the quintessential view of so many people's view of England. That sort of old thatch building, timber framed, with these riotous gardens with all this colour.
I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. It's such a treat to be able to hear from people like these guides from England about how they see their particular patch of the globe. It's what we aim to do each week on Travel with Rick Steves, to bring you voices from near and far, voices that teach us about how things look when you stand in someone else's shoes and get a fresh perspective on our world. We're holding this membership campaign today because we want to help make sure that fresh perspectives keep coming your way. The station that brings you this show relies on support of real people, people like you and me. Your support is a key component in bringing you the quality and substance you expect to hear right here every time you turn to this place on your dial. If you share my passion for the mission of public radio, if you agree that this is a very important part of the fabric of our community, then please take a moment right now and get on board. Find an amount that works for you and give us a ring. It's easy, it's fast, and you'll be glad you did. Public radio gives us perspectives on the world that we just don't find anywhere else on the dial. It inspires us, engages us, and equips us to better understand our fast-changing world. And your financial support makes this station possible. It also allows Travel with Rick Steves to return each week to keep us sharing these perspectives with you. If you've already made your contribution to public radio, thank you. If you're thinking about it, why not take a moment to contribute right now? Then, every time you listen to Travel with Rick Steves, you'll know that you and I are indeed travel partners in supporting public radio. Please, give us a ring right now. We're counting on you.